Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt. Specifically, Life and Debt Web are the shows that are related to this book. Now, last week we ended with the fact that in January of 1835, in what may have been his finest hour, President Jackson paid off the final installment on the national debt. He had succeeded in doing something that had really never been done before and unfortunately has not been done since. He reduced the national debt to zero and accumulated a surplus. The following year, the charter for the Second Bank of the United States expired. And the conclusion is that President Jackson had beaten the bank. His personal secretary, Nicholas Trist, called it the crowning glory of AJ's life and the most important service he has ever rendered to his country. The Boston Post compared it to Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple, but Jackson, like Jesus, found that taking on the money changers was risky business. "The bank is trying to kill me," he said, "but I will kill it." He was the victim of an assassination attempt, but both the assassin's shots missed him. But as we continue in our historical review, Abraham Lincoln was next in line, and he was not so lucky. Abraham Lincoln was called the scarecrow with the brain, and he really foiled the bankers. In fact, in the movie, Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz said to the scarecrow, "With the thoughts you'd been thinking, you could be another Lincoln if you only had a brain." Like the scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz, who actually wound up ruling Oz, Abraham Lincoln went from hayseed to the top of his class by sheer native wit and determination, epitomizing the American dream. Following in the footsteps of Andrew Jackson, he rose from the backwoods to the presidency without ever going to college. Lincoln's mother could barely read. Like Jackson, Lincoln risked life and limb battling the money power. But the two presidents had quite different ideas about how it should be done. Jackson had captured the popular imagination by playing on the distrust of big banks and foreign bankers. But in throwing out the National Bank and its foreign controllers, he had thrown out Hamilton's baby with the bathwater, leaving the banks in unregulated chaos. There was now no national currency. Banks printed their own notes and simply had to be trusted to redeem them in specie, which is gold bullion. When trust faltered, there would be a run on the bank, and the bank would generally wind up closing its doors. Bank-fed speculation had collapsed much of the factory system, and federal support for road, canal, and railway construction was halted, halting the pioneer settlement of the West along with it. Lincoln was only 24 when he joined the fight as an Illinois state legislator to continue the pioneering internal improvements begun by Henry Clay and the National Republicans. The National Republicans were now called Whigs, after the British Whigs, the party in opposition to the king. Jackson had taken such unprecedented powers to himself that he had come to be called King Andrew, making the American opposition party Whigs by extension. The Illinois Improvement Program of Lincoln's home state centered on construction of the Illinois-Michigan Canal and a 3,000-mile railroad system. The result was an unbroken transportation line from the Hudson River to the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River. Lincoln also joined the movement to restore the country's financial, industrial, and political independence by restoring a national bank and a national currency. When the Whig Party disintegrated over the question of slavery, Lincoln joined the Republican Party, which was created in 1854 to oppose the expansion of slavery into Kansas. It opposed the political control exerted by Southern slave owners over the national government, maintained that free market labor was superior to slavery, promised free homesteads to farmers, and advanced a progressive vision emphasizing higher education, banking, railroads, industry, and cities. Lincoln became the first Republican candidate to be elected president. Both President Jackson and Abraham Lincoln were targets of assassination attempts, but for Lincoln, they started before he was even inaugurated. He had to deal with treason, insurrection, and national bankruptcy within the first days of taking office. Considering the powerful forces arrayed against him, his achievements in the next 4 years were nothing short of phenomenal. His government built and equipped the largest army in the world, smashed the British-financed insurrection, abolished slavery, and freed 4 million slaves. Along the way, the country managed to become the greatest industrial giant the world had ever seen. The steel industry was launched, a continental railroad system was created, the Department of Agriculture was created, a new era of farm machinery and cheap tools was promoted, a system of free higher education was established through the land-grant college system, land development was encouraged by passage of a Homestead Act, granting ownership privileges to settlers, major government support was provided to all branches of science, The Bureau of Mines was organized. Governments in the Western Territories were established. The judicial system was reorganized. Labor productivity increased 50 to 75%, and standardization and mass production was promoted worldwide. That was Abraham Lincoln. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Well, how did Lincoln accomplish all of these goals? With a treasury that was completely broke and a Congress that hadn't been paid themselves. As Benjamin Franklin might have said, that is simple. Lincoln tapped into the same cornerstone that had gotten the impoverished colonists through the American Revolution and a long period of internal development before that. He authorized the government to issue its own paper fiat money. National control was reestablished over banking, and the economy was jump-started with a 600% increase in government spending and cheap credit directed at production. A century later, Franklin Roosevelt would use the same techniques to pull the country through the Great Depression, but Roosevelt's New Deal would be financed with borrowed money, which is, again, the mistake. Lincoln's government used a system of payment that was closer to the medieval tally, which we had discussed in the past. Officially called United States notes, these 19th century tallies were popularly called greenbacks because they were printed on the back with green ink, a feature that the dollar retains today. They were basically just receipts acknowledging work done or goods delivered, which could be traded in the community for an equivalent value of goods or services. Underscoring again, that is really the purpose of money. The greenbacks represented man hours rather than borrowed gold. Lincoln is quoted as saying, "The wages of men should be recognized as more important than the wages of money." Over 400 million greenbacks were printed and used to pay soldiers and government employees and to buy supplies for the war. The greenback system was not actually Lincoln's idea, but when pressure grew in Congress for the plan, he was very quick to endorse it. The South had seceded from the Union soon after his election in 1860. To fund the war between the states, the Eastern banks had offered a loan package that was little short of extortion. $150 million advanced at interest rates from 24 to 36%. Lincoln knew the loan would be impossible to pay off. He took the revolutionary approach because he had no other real choice. The government could either print its own money or succumb to debt slavery to the bankers. Footnote, which we have done today. Lincoln's economic advisor was Henry Carey, the son of Matthew Carey, the printer and publisher mentioned in earlier shows, who was tutored by Benjamin Franklin and himself tutored Henry Clay. Clay was the leader of the Philadelphia-based political faction propounding the American system of economics. In the 1920s, historian Vernon Parrington called Henry Carey our first professional economist. Thomas DiLorenzo, a modern libertarian writer, has called him Lincoln's and the Republican Party's economic guru. Carey was known around the world during the Civil War and its aftermath, and his writings were translated into many European and Asian languages. According to Parrington, Carey began his career as a classical laissez-faire economist from the British school, but he came to believe that the American industrial development was being held back by a false financial policy imposed by foreign financiers. To recognize only gold bullion as money gave the bankers who controlled the gold a lock on the money supply and the economy. The price of gold was established in a world market, and the flow of bullion was always toward the great financial centers that were already glutted with it. to throw the world's money into a common pool that drained into these financial capitals was to make poorer countries the servants of these hubs. Since negative trade balances were settled in gold, gold followed the balance of trade, and until America could build up an adequate domestic economy, its gold would continue to drain off, leaving too little money for its internal needs. Carey came to consider free trade and the gold standard to be twin financial weapons forged by England for its own economic conquest. His solution to the gold drain was for the government to create an independent national currency that was non-exportable, one that would remain at home to do the country's own work. He advocated a currency founded on national credit, something he defined as a national system based entirely on the credit of the government with the people, not liable to interference from abroad. Like the wooden tally, this paper money would simply be a unit of account that tallied work performed and goods delivered. Carey also supported expanding the monetary base with silver. Carey's theories were an elaboration of the American system propounded by Henry Clay and the National Republican Party. Their platform was to nurture local growth and development using local raw materials and local money, freeing the country from dependence on foreign financing. Where Jackson's Democratic Party endorsed free trade, the National Republican Party sought another sort of freedom, the right to be free from exploitation by powerful foreign financiers and industrialists. Free traders wanted freedom from government. Protectionists looked to the government to keep them free from foreign marauders. Clay's protectionist platform included the following: government regulation of banking and credit to deter speculation and encourage economic development. Government support for the development of science, public education, and national infrastructure. Regulation of privately held infrastructure to ensure it met the nation's needs. A program of government-sponsored railroads and scientific and other aid to small farmers. Taxation and tariffs to protect and promote productive domestic activity. And rejection of class wars, exploitation and slavery, physical or economic, in favor of a harmony of interests between capital and labor. President Lincoln also endorsed these goals. He eliminated slavery, established a national bank, and implemented and funded national education, national transportation, and federal development of business and farming. He also set very high tariffs. He made this common sense observation, quote, "I don't know much about the tariff, but I know this much. When we buy manufactured goods abroad, we get the goods and the foreigners get the money. When we buy the manufactured goods at home, we get both the goods and the money." If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The greenback system undergirded Lincoln's program of domestic development by providing a much-needed national paper money supply. After Jackson had closed the central bank, the only paper money in circulation were the banknotes issued privately by individual state banks, and they were basically just private promises to pay later in hard currency, which was gold or silver. The greenbacks, on the other hand, were currency. They were legal tender in themselves, money that did not have to be repaid later, but was as good as gold in trade. Like metal coins, the greenbacks were permanent money that could continue to circulate in their own right. The Legal Tender Acts of 1862 and 1863 made all the coins and currency issued by the U.S. government legal tender for all debts, public and private. Government-issued paper notes were made a legal substitute for gold and silver, even for the payment of pre-existing debt. In the 20th century, the legal tender statute applied this definition of legal tender to Federal Reserve notes, but it was an evident distortion of the intent of the original acts, which made only currency issued by the United States government legal tender. Remember, Federal Reserve notes are issued by the Federal Reserve, a private banking corporation, but that rather obvious discrepancy was slipped past the American people with the smoke and mirrors illusion that the Federal Reserve was actually federal. An issue arises on what President Lincoln did regarding inflation. Lincoln's greenback program has been blamed for the price inflation occurring during the Civil War, but according to Erwin Unger in The Greenback Era, published in 1964, he said, "It is now clear that inflation would have occurred even without the greenback issue. As we should know, war is always an inflationary venture. What forced prices up during the Civil War was actually a severe shortage of goods." Zarlinga quotes historian J.G. Randall, who observed in 1937, quote, "The threat of inflation was more effectively curbed during the Civil War than during the First World War. Indeed, as John K. Galbraith has observed, it is remarkable that without rationing, price controls, or central banking, Treasury Secretary Chase could have managed the federal economy so well during the Civil War." End of quote. Greenbacks were not the only source of funding for the Civil War. Bonds, which are government IOUs, were also issued, and these too increased the money supply, since the banks that bought the bonds were also short of gold and had no other way of paying for the bonds than with their own newly issued banknotes. The difference between the government-issued greenbacks and the bank-issued banknotes was that the greenbacks were debt-free legal tender that did not have to be paid back. As Thomas Edison reasonably observed in an interview reported in the New York Times in 1921, quote, "If the nation can issue a dollar bond, it can issue a dollar bill. The element that makes the bond good makes the bill good also. The difference between the bond and the bill is that the bond lets the money broker collect twice the amount of the bond and an additional 20%. Whereas the currency, the honest sort provided by the Constitution, pays nobody but those who contribute in some useful way. It is absurd to say our country can issue bonds and cannot issue currency. Both are promises to pay, but one fattens the usurer and the other helps the people." The greenbacks did lose value as against gold during the war, but this was to be expected since gold was a more established currency that people naturally preferred. Again, the problem for the greenback was that it had to compete with other forms of currency. People remained suspicious of paper money, and the greenback was not accepted for everything. Particularly, it could not be used for the government's interest payments on its outstanding bonds to the private banks. Zarlinga notes that by December 1865, the greenback was still worth 68 cents to one gold dollar. Not bad under the circumstances. Meanwhile, the Confederates' paper notes had become devalued so much that they were worthless. The Confederacy had made the mistake of issuing fiat money that was not legal tender, but was only a bond or promise to pay after the war. As the defeat of the Confederacy became more and more certain, its currency's value plummeted. In 1972, the United States Treasury Department was asked to compute the amount of interest that would have been paid if the $400 million in greenbacks had been borrowed from the banks instead. According to the Treasury Department's calculations, in his short tenure, Lincoln saved the government a total of $4 billion in interest just by avoiding this $400 million loan. We're seeing some very valuable lessons here, lessons the current government should be taking to heart. The Confederacy was not the only power that was bent on destroying Lincoln's Union government. Lurking behind the curtain, pulling the strings of war, were powerful foreign financiers. Otto von Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany in the second half of the 19th century, called these puppeteers the masters of European finance. He is quoted as saying, "I know of absolute certainty that the division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained in one block and as one nation, would attain economic and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over Europe and the world." Of course, in the inner circle of finance, the voice of the Rothschilds prevailed. They saw an opportunity for prodigious booty if they could substitute two feeble democracies burdened with the debt to the financiers in place of a vigorous republic sufficient unto herself. Therefore, they sent their emissaries into the field to exploit the question of slavery and to drive a wedge between the two parts of the Union. The rupture between the North and the South became inevitable. The masters of European finance employed all their forces to bring it about and to turn it to their advantage. The European bankers wanted a war that would return the United States to its colonial status, but they were not necessarily interested in preserving slavery. Slavery just meant that the owners had to feed and care for their workers. The bankers preferred the European plan. Capital could exploit labor by controlling the money supply while letting the laborers feed themselves. In July 1862, this ploy was revealed in a notorious document called the Hazard Circular, which was reported to have been circulated by British banking interests among their American banking counterparts. It said, quote, "Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery destroyed. This, I and my European friends are glad of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers, while the European plan, led by England, is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. The great debt that capitalists will see to it is made out of the war, must be used as a means to control the volume of money. To accomplish this, the bonds must be used as a banking basis. It will not do to allow the greenback, as it is called, to circulate as money any length of time, as we cannot control that." The system the bankers wanted to preserve was what Henry Clay and Henry Carey had called the British system, with its twin weapons of free trade and the gold standard, keeping the less industrialized countries in a colonial state, supplying raw materials to Britain's factories. The American South had already been subjugated in this way, and the bankers had now set their sights on the North to be reeled in with usurious war loans, but Lincoln had refused to take the bait. The threat the new greenback system posed to the bankers' game was reflected in an editorial that is of uncertain origin, but was reportedly published in the London Times in 1865. It warned, "If that mischievous financial policy, which had its origin in the North American Republic, should become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off debts and be without a debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous beyond precedent in the history of the civilized governments of the world. The brains and the wealth of all countries will go to North America. That government must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeindebt@gmail.com.
I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.